Hello and welcome to The Zesty Garden. I'm your host, Brian Earle. In the studio with me today is USU's Extension Vegetable Specialist, Dan Drost. And we're going to talk vegetables this morning. And so if you can call us with your question or comment, we'd love to hear from you. It's 1-800-826-1495. You can also send us an email question. It's zestygarden@gmail.com. Or go to the Utah Public Radio Facebook page and post your question there. Dan, thanks for coming in.
Well, you know, it is March, and you know what that means.
It's another growing season.
That's right. It tumbles on us faster than we would like, but I think, you know, it'll be another interesting year with lots of wonderful things that'll happen, and if I could look into my crystal ball about how well things will occur... Don't ask me to do that.
I was going to say, how is my asparagus bed going to turn out this year?
I don't have a clue.
Well, this is the time of year. Hope springs eternal.
Yes, that's right. And certainly farmers and gardeners are some of the most optimistic individuals in the world because they know that if they put a seed in the ground or a plant in the ground, that something will happen to it. It will live, it will die, it will grow, it will produce fruit, it won't produce fruit. There are a myriad of things that could potentially happen, and our goal, I think, in the Zesty Garden, as well as our goal each month when I come to talk, is to try and create information for the listening audience that will help their garden be more successful. And so through our conversations, through your experiences in your garden, through the stuff that I see and know, through the publications that we develop, through all of those resources that are available to us, you know, the crystal ball shouldn't be too cloudy. It should be lots of sunshine, you know, adequate moisture, good fertility, you know, may your pest problems be minimal. And as a result, your garden's successful. And so that's really what we're here about.
I have one prediction.
Okay.
Based on my experience over the last 47 years that I've grown something.
Yeah, yeah.
And that is that I will probably have too much zucchini.
Yeah, well, and that, and there are ways to solve that problem. And, you know, when it's zucchini time, we can talk again about, you know, the need not to plant so much, which, you know, invariably we think that when we're putting a seed in the ground that some of them don't come up. Well, that's usually the wrong approach to take. One should assume that if you look at the germination percentage that's on a seed packet or something like that, that number reasonably reflects what we might expect to see come up. And the audience should understand that those things aren't necessarily the same. So when you go purchase some seed and it says that it's 85% germination, what that means is that if you put those seeds under ideal conditions, and we're going to talk about some of those conditions for growing plants, that you would expect 85% of them to come up. So out of every 100 you plant, 85 should be there. Now, that's only under ideal conditions. However, in the real world of your garden, my garden, you know, that might not always happen. And some people kind of expect that. And so, you know, we need to be thinking about planting in a way that we're utilizing the space in our garden most efficiently. And then how do we get back to that? So we often suggest that you overplant in order to get back to 100% stand, because that's really when we're going to have the most productivity. The layout of those plants is important so that they're most productive. Just having plant material in place tends to crowd out other things, and our main problems each year are weeds in our garden. If we do some of those things right up front, the net effect is that our garden's going to be productive, and certainly people rely on their garden to provide them with fresh produce. You know, you're picking it at the peak of its maturity and ripeness and freshness and nutrient content. Those are all important things for us. And then if we're, you know, trying to be a little bit frugal in an environment, in an economy that we feel is not so manageable for us anymore, then, you know, maybe we need to say, yeah, we got to have enough so that I can can some and eat some and put some away for the winter. And certainly I know when I pull fresh corn out of the freezer, yeah, it's not quite like it is off the cob, but boy, it's pretty darn close because it's really good stuff that I put into the freezer. Or if I'm doing that with, you know, peaches that are coming off my tree, I always have more than I know what to do with. So by putting some away, I've got some jam or I've got some whole peaches that I like this morning on my cereal. I had yogurt and peaches and the cereal, and that was really yummy.
So something, as I was going through a catalog looking at seeds, something that you had said to one of our callers last summer, really, it just popped into my mind again, and we'll explore more of this in May, but it's the idea, as you were talking about space, it's the idea of not having too much competition in one hole, but planting a little bit closer together.
Yeah.
So in relationship to
so what were you
squash
or what were you reading
watermelon.
About? Okay, yeah.
Yeah, or cantaloupe, for instance.
Yeah, you know, it's kind of that way with anything that we're doing. And, you know, we're at that point where there's opportunity for us if the surface of the soil dries out a little bit. If, you know, they've talked about a little bit more rain in northern Utah anyway. But if you're in southern Utah, you're already planting. You should have onions in the ground. You should have planted radishes. You should have spinach growing. You should have lettuce. I mean, they should have been done doing that a month ago. And getting those plants up and running. You know, the important thing is that, as one of my instructors said way back when I was just a student, he said, if you don't have a plant, you don't have production. And that stuck with me. That was one of those kind of things that, yeah, you know, it's a truism that we can take to heart, that if we are missing a plant as you go down your planting row and you're not utilizing that space, I mean, in that particular location, you have no production. And overall of the space that you're growing, your production is somewhat less because plants compensate to a certain extent for openness in the environment. So an area that doesn't have a plant in it, they will kind of try to fill that space, but not all of them do that as in an equal way. And so if you're thinking about onion or if you're thinking about radishes or something like that, their ability to grow into an open area is somewhat limited. Now, if we're talking about squash or melons, that's a different story. They tend to be a little bit more successful at doing that, but too many of those open spaces actually then impact your productivity potential. And so our goal this morning, I think, is to start to think about some of those concepts as we talk about what we can plant in the garden and the importance of, you know, finding out what the ideal arrangement of your plants are in the garden so that you're going to try and optimize production as we think and look into our crystal ball.
So when you're thinking of things that should be planted right now, like onions, for instance, mm-hmm. how early do you need to make sure? Because I always plant from seed
right.
into the garden. I've just found to get my largest bulbs by doing that, and I stick them in as early as I can get the ground worked. Have great germination. But there's some point in there that if I haven't thinned them, but I do later, tough luck. They don't get that big. So at what point do you need to go in and thin them out? Because they do need to have some room to grow, but...
Yeah, you know, ultimately the space or the distance from one plant to the next tends to regulate how big a crop like an onion bulb turns out to be. So if you have all of them spaced 1 inch apart, the bulk of the onions that grow from that at the end of the year will be about 1 inch in diameter because the competition that they're going to get from the next bulb in the row is going to help restrict how much expansion you can get. So now that's kind of simplistic way of looking at it and thinking about it, but that's why so much work has been done over so many years to try and find out what the ideal plant arrangement is. So arrangement basically has to do with the spacing that you have in the planting row, so how far the plants are apart, and how far the plants are apart from each other, one row to the next. And certainly those, that arrangement dictates how much growing area a plant has. And so with onions, we would say, yeah, your rows should be 3 or 4 inches apart, and your plant should be about 2 inches apart within the row, and then the bulk of your onion bulbs at the end of the growing season are going to be about 2 to 2.5 inches in diameter, which is what we would call a medium-sized onion bulb, which is about the amount that you need for most dishes that you would cook with that would be required for a family of four. So you need.
So you don't necessarily want them to get gigantic.
Well, you may if you have a larger family. Or if you're a person that likes to make French onion soup all the time, you know, what would you rather do? Peel 20 onion bulbs that are 4 inches in diameter, or I can't even do the math on that. It might be, you know, 80 bulbs that are 2 inches in diameter. You see the difference because of the volume and the amount of product that's inside that bulb that's going to go into the stew pot that's going to make French onion soup. So naturally, it kind of depends on that. But if you're doing a dish that, let's say you're going to make some marinara sauce tonight and you need onion for that, and there's you and your wife and your two kids and that's what's going to be for dinner, well, you can take a great big onion bulb, use part of it, put the other away and use it sometime later, or you can have a bulb that's about the right size to go in that, and it's a one-off type of deal. So whatever your needs are is kind of dictating what you're going to do in the garden as you think about how far apart those plants are going to be. So if you like larger bulbs, you're going to have them a little farther apart. Now, that brings us back to the question of, well, I want to get a nice uniform stand down the row. I'm going to overseed, so, and then I'm going to thin them back out. At what point do I see a problem when I start to thin that impacts how well that bulb occurs? Well, interestingly enough, in onion, this work has been done as well. We find that if we start to thin them after they start to set bulbs, or after the bulb starts to enlarge, which usually occurs around the middle of July, that's when we start seeing a yield depression. So before then, essentially, we would probably be okay, provided when we do our thinnings, we're not disturbing the root system of the adjacent plant to the extent where we've actually done some root pruning, which then means the plant has to replace a root that I've damaged in order for it to maintain its growth. And so it starts putting energy away from leaf growth and back into root growth.
So it sounds like I should do thinning throughout the spring.
Exactly.
The smaller ones uses bunching onions and then start using them as they get a little bit bigger to allow them more room.
Yeah. And so if you kind of work your way through what most people do is they start on one end of the row and start thinning and they leave the other end of the row thick. And, you know, so now the competition is greater and greater and greater, and you're extending it later and later and later into the growing season. That's when that competition really starts to impact how that plant grows. And one needs to remember with onion anyway, each leaf that grows above ground is a ring for the bulb later on in the year. And so the more leaves I initiate, the more rings I get, and the bigger the potential size of that plant is going to be. And so there's a you know, kind of interesting nuances within all of our plants. Now, how does that relate to something like spinach or lettuce or something like that? Really, there where we're interested in harvesting leaves at any time, we could go in and have a very, very heavy planting, a lot of plants growing in there. Each one grows a little bit smaller, but the sum of all of them produce the amount of biomass that we want. And then if we just trim off the upper surface of the leaf and leave the growing point in place, it'll sprout back up again in a few weeks, and we kind of work our way down the row, and we don't need to thin something like these leafy crops that would tie.
So you can plant them fairly thick if you want.
Very thick, very thick. And that's a really nice way to do it. And still then just trim off what I need for a salad for tonight. And in 2 or 3 weeks, I've got growth back in that location, and I can trim off in that area again for another salad. So there's differences depending on what you're trying to accomplish. And so with those crops that are producing like single units of production, like an onion bulb, a single bulb, versus I just need leaf tissue and I don't really care whether it comes from one plant or 20 plants, I'm trying to accomplish a different goal with those different types of plants.
If I have a salad, a leafy green, like a Boston type. It's not going to be a tight head, but it is going to be a head nonetheless. How much do I have to thin those out? I mean, does that make a difference with those types?
Yeah, usually with the heading types, wherever we're trying to do that. So if we think about a bib lettuce or some of the cos type lettuce, those that are more upright, you know, and produce a kind of a tall, narrow plant, you know, think about, again, how big around you want that plant to be. If you're saying with a bib type lettuce, I need a head that's maybe 6 inches in diameter in order to produce enough lettuce for me to, say, use two of those to make the salad that I need for tonight. Well, then the final spacing on that should be roughly the size of that end product that you're going to harvest. And one can go out and leave them closer together and harvest every other one at a smaller size so that about the time we say that you need to thin is when they start touching each other. Because that's when the competition starts to set in. They're competing not only for the nutrients and the water that's in the soil, the root systems are competing, but when the leaves start competing with each other, that's when mutual shading is going on, and that also slows up their growth. So normally start shading when they start to interfere with each other, their leaves start touching, that's a good time to do it. Thin them out. There's several ways you can do that. In terms of your onions, you know, rather than literally pull them up, just go in with a knife and just cut them slightly below ground so that you're cutting the root system off. That way you don't disturb the root system of the adjacent plant that you want to create a bulb on. And then it's where you don't normally eat the root system anyway. So just leave that in the garden and pull up the tops and use those tops for your green onions in a salad or in a stir fry or whatever you're going to do with it.
What about peas? I typically will plant as close together as I possibly can, thinking that I'm going to get more, but now I'm thinking maybe I shouldn't be doing that.
Yeah, you know, peas are funny. I think what historically why we plant them as close together as we do, you know, maybe 1 inch apart or something like that with the seeds, is that at this time of the year, they're notoriously prone to sitting in wet, cold soils, and they don't all sprout, and therefore we don't get a very good stand. And so by doing more seeds, we essentially get adequate number. But there is this role of competition, again, as we've been talking, in that if you have two plants growing close together and you look at the productivity over a set distance, so let's say look at how many peas we're producing for every foot of row that we have, if I have them at 1 inch apart and I have 12 plants in that region, then that produces, let's say, 24 pea pods. If I had half that many, I still produce about 24 pea pods. And if I have one in there, that one plant will produce 24 pea pods because it has no competition. And so there tends to be the plants kind of self-regulate themselves to whatever the optimum or the ideal is. And so as we think about it, we're really saying, well, how do I use that space most efficiently? And I also want it to be somewhat concentrated in maturity so that I have enough that I can pick to be able to, you know, serve peas with whatever I'm serving peas with tonight. And so getting, once again, getting back to that ideal plant population, we publish that information in the fact sheets. And for a crop like peas, you'd want about, you know, 3 to 5 plants per foot. That tends to give the optimum spacing. It gives the best competition. It also helps to shade out what's underneath and does those things. And if we plant more than that, we oftentimes don't get any more production. If we underplant that, yeah, we get more production per plant, but it may be spread out over a longer period of time, and I don't get the concentration of maturity that I'm interested in. So some concentration, some competition between plants also helps to create uniformity of maturity, which might be important for me as well.
I'm just thinking of, I'm looking at my hands a foot apart, and I'll bet I had 15...
Yeah, seeds in there.
Seeds all the way through, and they all germinated.
Yeah, so. Well, that's unusual, though. I mean, seriously, with peas, that's fairly unusual that oftentimes when we start, particularly in our very earliest plantings, and it's not unrealistic for us to think about starting to plant peas sometime here in late March up in the northern half of Utah, at that we overseed because they tend not all to come up. And so our goal is to try and create enough plants to get the kind of production we're after. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if we do get a situation where, like you said, yeah, I planted 15 and every 15 came up, well, some of those plants, if you actually went through and looked at them, didn't produce any pods at all. Because the competition is just too great in there. And so the plant tends to start to act like if you had a single plant in that same space. And that tends to be the way plants self-regulate themselves.
So right now, what would you, if someone could get into the ground and have it, and it's workable, you mm-hmm. don't, of course, you don't want to get into it if it's still
sticky on
got
the surface.
Sticky, or yeah. You can squeeze water out of it, definitely. But what would you plant right now
if you could get in? Yeah. I mean, I was out yesterday with a grower. We were looking at, you know, he's a cooperator that I plant onions with. We were making sure that we were ready to get going as soon as the soil dries out. Yeah, it's been too wet. They've got moisture on there. And so we would plant onions or leeks. Those are good ones to start with. If the ground is set up and ready to plant, spinach can go in the ground, endive, arugula, all of those kind of cold weather crops, some pak choy seed to get, you know, Chinese cabbage out of it. You could plant carrots. You can plant your parsnips.
Carrots could go in this early?
Yes.
Okay.
I mean, they're going to be a little slow in their germination, but, you know, the nice thing about it is that we plant those really close to the surface, and we tend to are favoring a moist environment up near the surface right now, that if we wait another month to do it, it's a little bit warmer, it's a little bit drier on the surface, and we oftentimes run into establishment problems. So the establishment is not because of the seed, it's because the soil is a little too dry where we're trying to put it. So lettuces, spinach, arugulas, endives, all of those kind of leafy greens, kales, mustards, some of those, your pak choys could go in, which you would be seeding in the ground. We could do, as I said, onion and leek. We could get our peas started, of course, as soon as we can get in there. So there are a lot of options, carrots and parsnips and radish and those types of things. Some of them will be a little slow in their emergence, but, you know, we've had reasonably warm weather. We have warm nights. I mean, that soil is warming up a lot, other than the fact that we've had a little bit too much rain. And, well, I'm going to take that back. Not too much rain. We've had nice rains. They haven't been terribly hard. You know, the ground is nice and saturated now. So we're just kind of waiting for the garden to dry out a little bit so that I can do that. And if you did what we talked about in October, where you made some fall beds, got them raised up, you know, the soil has mellowed itself out, you just need to go in there right now and with a rake, smooth the surface a little bit, and you're ready to plant. It's not going to take too much to dry out, and we can get a whole bunch of stuff in. And I had intended, I've got some flower boxes that are raised beds that I was going to plant up last weekend if the weather was good. It wasn't. You know, if the weather's good this weekend and they dry out a little bit on the surface, they're going to get planted with all of those types of things, mostly lettuces and that type of stuff I put in them, leafy greens for early salads and those things. So those will go in probably this weekend if we don't get any moisture out of this storm today and tomorrow. Otherwise, it'll probably be midweek next week because they said there's going to be a drying trend again. And so I'm going to, you know, I'm ready to go because the beds have been worked over. I just need to kind of rake them off and go.
I have a friend who used to live across the street from us who's now in Minnesota.
Oh, dear.
And she was posting some pictures to her Facebook page, and the snow was deeper than the cars on the street. It just piled up, and I said, I'm planting peas this weekend.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. And, you know, the one nice thing about something like pea that you might want to consider with those, if you've had problems with emergence in the past, what I often recommend people do is that, you know, get the peas started in some paper towels and germinate them inside the house, and then just plant out the germinated ones, because not all of them germinate. And boy, they just get a little bit of a head start when they go into the garden by just planting the ones with a little bit of a sprouted root on them. Now, the only difficulty with that is if the weather isn't good and the seeds are ready and the garden isn't ready, that you can't get them in there. And that's why people don't often do that.
Well, I'm going to ask a question about seed depth. We're going to take a quick break, and then we'll be back in just about a minute. Dan Drost, USU Extension Vegetable Specialist, is my guest. If you have a question or comment, the toll-free number is 1-800-826-1495. 826-1495. Send us an email question. It's zestygarden@gmail.com, or post your question or comment to the Utah Public Radio Facebook page. We'll be back in just a moment. The Be Well Moment is made possible by the USU Department of Human Resources Wellness Program at usu.edu/HR.
How do you manage work-life balance? For many of us, life seems to have two speeds, fast and faster. The pressures at work are followed by the needs and demands at home. A recent study found that more than half of American workers felt overwhelmed by their workload at some point. Even so, one-third of those surveyed had no plans to make the vacation days they had available. No matter how energetic you may be, stretching yourself to the limit every day puts your health and happiness at risk. Frequent stress takes a mental and physical toll on your body. If you are often stressed out, you may feel irritated, worried, or depressed, and may have frequent headaches, backaches, or an upset stomach. A wise goal is simply to do what you reasonably can. This will help you strive for a balance between your work and home activities. If you can also manage to take time for yourself every day, you'll be on the road to a greater well-being. This is Dana Barrett for the Be Well program at Utah State University. Be well, Utah.
Programming on Utah Public Radio is made possible in part by our members and the Wasserman Festival, presenting pianists from the Tchaikovsky and Van Cliburn International Piano Competitions in concert March 6th, 20th, and 21st at 7:30 p.m. in the USU Performance Hall. Tickets at arts.usu.edu.
Welcome back to the second part of The Zesty Garden. I'm your host, Brian Earle. Dan Drost, USU Extension Vegetable Specialist, is my guest, and we'd love to hear from you. It's 1-800-826-1495, or post your question or comment to the Utah Public Radio Facebook page, or email us at zestygarden@gmail.com. So I wanted to ask about planting depth. Does it generally follow the size of the seed, meaning how deep you plant it?
Yeah, I mean, a good rule of thumb that I tend to tell people to think about is, you know, if you took a marble and stuck it in the palm of your hand, the way that marble sits, you look at how tall that marble is as it lays in your hand or in the palm of your hand, and then you should plant about three times as deep as that. Okay? So if you have a seed like
Carrot
seed, it's when it lays in your palm
it's
of
flat.
Your hand, it's relatively flat, and it's very doesn't have a lot of height to it, so you're not going to plant it very deep. If you have a pea seed, which is kind of round like a marble, you're going to plant that quite a bit deeper, up to maybe 3/4 of an inch deep, because it can be maybe 1/4 inch tall. So your three times is 3/4 rather than the 1/4 inch that the thickness of that or the height of that is as it lays normally in the palm of your hand. So you can get an estimate of what the depth should be based on that.
So three times.
Three times that.
Okay.
And that will be about the right depth for it. We don't have a lot of seeds that are very large. Your biggest ones are some of your beans. So if you were growing lima bean or something like that, it's quite a large seed. But when it lays in your palm, it lays on the side, so its thickness isn't really too great. So the depth doesn't have to be too great either.
So that would be the same for cantaloupe?
It would be the same for anything.
Zucchini seeds, even though they look...
Yeah, they look big, and some people say, yeah, I got to poke them in one end down or something like that. Well, you know, that works okay, but it's still the 3X rule, I call it. I have 5 rules of gardening that I think people need to remember. And
okay, everybody write these down.
Well, we're not going to talk about all the rules. I'm going to only give you rule number one.
Okay.
Okay? And the rule number one is the seeding depth rule. And that's the 3X rule, I call it. So 3 times the height of the seed when it lays normally in the palm of your hand. Now, if you took your squash seed or your melon seed, as you said, and tried to make it stand in the palm of your hand on the pointy end, would it do that? No, it doesn't do that. So it falls over and it lays on its side. And then if you look at that thickness or the height that we would call that, it's not that tall. So the depth might only be about a half an inch that you would plant those seeds. Depth-wise, and then that's at the appropriate depth for the most vigorous germination that you're going to see.
Well, and if you look at it, you lay it point size down, it's going to germinate, come out the top, but then it's still got to get the root down into it, and on the side, it's just going to go apart from each other.
Not necessarily, Brian, because one needs to understand when you look at a seed, you can actually tell where the radical, which is a small root, is going to come out. If you know anything about seed anatomy, you can physically look at the root, the seed, and tell from there where that's going to occur.
And a zucchini, that's pretty easy.
Yeah, it's
but
pretty,
what about a pea?
You can see it.
Okay.
Look at it next time. You can see it. It looks like a little finger that's laying up on the edge of the pea pod or the pea seed as you roll it around in your hand. And if you look closely, it helps sometimes to imbibe the seed. So put it in water, let it swell up, and then look at it. And you can really then begin to pick out where it is. And if you're uncertain, you know, just take off the seed coat and then look closely at it, and you'll see it there. So as you're thinking about it, yeah, you can directionally position them, but you still shouldn't violate rule number one. Rule number one says the 3X rule, and so the best thing to do is to lay them in according to that. And so seeds like carrots, seeds like lettuce, they're relatively small. They're going to be up close to the surface. Seeds like a radish is a circular seed. It's a little bit bigger than a, let's say, a brassica seed or a pak choi or a cabbage or something like that. So it's going to be a little bit deeper. A pea seed is a round seed. It's going to even be a little bit deeper. And so by just looking at the seed, you can actually figure out how deep to plant it. And the biggest reason why it's important to adhere to rule number one, which is our 3X rule, is that if we position that seed at the right location within the soil, we're going to get much, much better emergence of those seeds. So we talked about 85% germination at the beginning. We're actually going to maybe get 85% emergence from those seeds. In other words, everyone that germinates is also going to come up, and that's important for us. If we start planting them much deeper than what they're supposed to be planting at, then what happens is some of those seeds struggle to push their way up through too much soil, and they can't do it. And you as a gardener say, well, I had really poor emergence from that seed. Or more often what I hear people say to me, oh, I had really poor germination. And I said, really? How do you know that? Well, they didn't come up. I said, well, we're talking about two different things. Germination, by definition, is just the emergence of the radical out of the seed coat.
It's not appearing above the soil
is called emergence. So they're two different things. And so some gardeners tend to use the terms interchangeably, and they are not to be used interchangeably. And so it's critical for us to get them in the right place. And once we get them in the right place, then they have a much, much better chance of producing the plant stands that we want. And then you get the nice uniform rows that we can then get the high levels of productivity that we're trying to achieve.
Okay.
We talked about in the first half.
I always learn something. There's always a light bulb that goes off in my head, and I'm just going, well, what you say makes absolute sense. So why is it taking me 47 years to think, okay, germination is not above the soil?
Yeah. Well, I was reading an interesting article. I was chatting with one of our vegetable growers who raises greenhouse tomatoes. And I had another grower kind of talking to me about wanting to do this. And I had just recently read an article by a pretty prominent greenhouse tomato grower from back east. And he was helping another grower kind of learn the business. And he said something really interesting in his article. There are 100 things you need to know to grow greenhouse tomatoes. And I said, that's interesting. And I started to think, and I go, yeah, you know, you need to know about this and you need to know about that. And they started to add them up, and it didn't take me very long, and I was at 40. And he said, there's 100 things that you have to learn. He says, the one thing you do is you're going to learn one thing each year, right? And then you're going to know some of these other things. And he said, so in effect, what it means is that growing greenhouse tomatoes is you need to learn something new every year because something new is going to happen. So you say your light bulb clicked on, and last year you said it once or twice, oh, a light bulb clicked on in my head, and I'm not going to forget this. And it's kind of the analogy of the tomato grower is that there are so many things that you need to know about what's going on in your garden. There's soil issues. There's nutrient issues within the soil. There are nutrient imbalance issues within the soil. There are water-related issues within the soil. There are drought events. There are over-irrigation events. There are, you know, you see how I'm adding them up. And and each year we're going to learn some new things. And I'm not saying that you should only learn one thing this year about how to make your garden better. But let's try to say I'm going to learn 5 things or I'm going to learn 10 things. And then next year, you're going to learn 10 more things. But what happens is many people forget the 10 things they learned last year. And that's what we don't want to have happen. So the analogy of the tomato grower to the new tomato grower was you're going to learn, you got to learn and remember one thing for this year. Well, he really needs to learn a lot more than that. But it's just there's a lot to learn. Mm-hmm. And so hopefully through this program, what I've tried to do over, how many years have we been doing this? I was trying to remember.
Since about 1996.
Yeah, it was
95.
It was a few years after I came that we started. And you know, I've been a regular guest on here once a month. And I think about all the subjects that we talked about and re-talked about. And I have no way to know how our listening audiences, how many times the light bulb has gone on in their head. More so, I don't know how many of them remember that the light bulbs, how many light bulbs went on, and do they know that those bulbs are still on or have those bulbs gone off?
Every time a light bulb went off, I should have written it down.
Yeah. And so, you know, just that's my goal is that, you know, every time I say something, you learn something, but somebody out there in listening land also learns it.
Dan's 100 aphorisms.
Yeah. And so I'm gonna give the 5 rules this year.
Okay,
we haven't ever talked about the 5 rules.
We haven't.
I know we haven't. And so I said to myself, okay, I'm going to hit rule number 1, and next month I'll hit rule number 2, and then the next month I'll hit rule number 3. And they kind of go through the season as well, and we'll remind people of rule number 1 next week because they maybe didn't listen this month. And as a result, at the end of the summer, that's 5 things that you're going to have light bulbed on. And those light bulbs should stay on for, you know, for the next 40 years that you're growing in your garden or whatever it is. You got at least 40 more years under your belt.
I certainly hope so. I certainly hope so. Okay, so we're down to just literally like a minute and a half, 2 minutes left. So tell me why some people love broccoli or cabbage or cauliflower, but then you have someone like President Bush Sr., who just couldn't stand broccoli.
It has to do, I think, with flavor receptors in your mouth. And
so it's a genetic thing.
It probably is, yeah, more than anything. And in the brassicas or in the cruciferous vegetables.
What's the difference?
There is no difference.
Okay.
It's just it's a term that you use, the crucifers or the brassicaceae. It's a large family of plants that includes things like cabbage and kale, and mustards are in there, and radishes are in there, and all these things. But they produce these glycosides that have sulfur compounds in them, and some people are more reactive to those things. They don't like either the smell or the taste, and the sulfur materials tend to have a metallic taste on the tongue for some people, and that's an undesirable characteristic. So there are differences in our perceptions. I think we can train our systems to like some of these things.
Because I certainly didn't eat them very much when I was growing up.
No, I think a lot of young people, little kids, don't like them because they are sensitive to some of those flavors. And so you need to introduce them into the diet in a way that gets them familiar with it.
Put them in a casserole first.
They're really good for you, so we should be eating more of them. But some people don't like the smell, some don't like the taste, and that has to do with some of the compounds that the plant family produces.
And I'm assuming that some of those, like, I don't know, Brussels sprouts, might have more of those compounds than others, or are they just about the same?
You know, I don't know. I'll look at that, and we can maybe revisit this conversation next month, and I'll see whether there's variation. But I suspect there usually is, because I know there's variation between varieties. I would suspect that there may be variation between types, even though broccoli is Brassica oleracea and Brussels sprouts is Brassica oleracea. It's just a different sub-species. The two. So there could be variability there.
And we'll look forward to that conversation.
Well, great.
Dan, thank you.
It's always good. See ya.
You've been listening to The Zesty Garden. Dan Drost is USU's Extension Vegetable Specialist and will join us every first Thursday of each month. I had to look at my watch because I'm losing track of the time this spring.
First Thursday.
In our gardening calendar, the Tahnaquit Nature Center in St. George is featuring a free course on raised beds and gardening this Saturday from 10 to 11. The class will go over how to garden in raised beds and present the how-tos of creating your own raised beds. The Tahnaquit Nature Center is at 1851 South Dixie Drive. USU Extension in Emory and Carbon County is hosting a workshop on pruning fruit trees and shrubs. That's also this Saturday. It's at 6:30 p.m. For location information and to register, call 435-381-2381. They will also host a course on vegetable production on Thursday the 13th at 6:30 p.m. at the courthouse in Castledale. And USU Extension is hosting a native plant propagation workshop on Thursday the 13th from 6 to 9 at the USU Teaching Greenhouse at 1390 North 800 East in Logan. The same workshop is also taught on Saturday the 15th from 9 to noon. To register, call 752-6263. And then if I remember right, there is a pruning demonstration at the Utah Botanical Center this Saturday. And I can't remember the time, but just go online to take a look. Thanks for joining us on the program.
Good morning. I'm Nancy Williams, and I'm here for Petals and Prose today on The Zesty Garden. I'm going to be really brave and attempt to read from Henry David Thoreau's essay called Walking, which is a marvelous piece, but I realized when I started to review it that Henry David Thoreau wrote more like William Shakespeare, and so he's a challenge sometimes to read because occasionally his sentences run for half a page. So I will find out after we read this whether this is actually a doable thing or not. Just a little bit about Thoreau. He was born in Concord, Massachusetts in 1817 and died there on May 6, 1862. He was not very old when he died. But with the exception of brief periods of absence during his childhood and youth, and excursions in adult years to the Maine woods and the White Mountains, Cape Cod, Quebec, and other localities, and one longer trip to Minnesota in 1861, trying to recover his health, Thoreau's whole life was spent within the borders of his native town of Concord. This was a distinction that he loved. "I cannot but regard it," he said, "as a kindness in those who have the steering of me, that by the want of pecuniary wealth I have been nailed down to this my native region so long and steadily, and made to study and love this spot of earth more and more. What would signify in comparison a thin and diffused love and knowledge of the whole earth instead got by wandering? So he was plugged into the area around Concord and Walden Pond his entire life, and that is reflected in his reading. He opens his essay called Walking this way. I wish to speak a word for nature, for absolute freedom and wildness, as contrasted with a freedom and culture merely civil, to regard man as an inhabitant or part and parcel of nature rather than a member of society. I wish to make an extreme statement, if so I may make an emphatic one, for there are enough champions of civilization. The minister and the school committee and every one of you will take care of that. Excerpted from his essay. I think that I cannot preserve my health and spirits unless I spend 4 hours a day at least, and it's commonly more than that, sauntering through the woods and over the hills and fields, absolutely free from all worldly engagement. You may safely say a penny for your thoughts or 1,000 pounds. When sometimes I'm reminded that the mechanics and shopkeepers stay in their shops not only all the forenoon but all the afternoon too, sitting with crossed legs, so many of them, as if the legs were made to sit upon and not to stand or walk upon, I think that they deserve some credit for not having all committed suicide long ago. I, who cannot stay in my chamber for a single day without acquiring some rust, and when sometimes I have stolen forth for a walk at the 11th hour of 4 o'clock in the afternoon, too late to redeem the day, when the shades of night were already beginning to be mingled with the daylight, have felt as if I had committed some sin to be atoned for, I confess that I am astonished at the power of endurance, to say nothing of the moral insensibility of my neighbors who confine themselves to shops and offices the whole day long for weeks and months, aye, and years almost together. I know not what manner of stuff they are of, sitting there now at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, as if it were 3 o'clock in the morning. Bonaparte may talk of the 3 o'clock in the morning courage, but it is nothing to the courage which can sit down cheerfully at this hour in the afternoon over against oneself, whom you've known all the morning, to starve out a garrison to whom you are bound by such strong ties of sympathy. I wonder that about this time, or say between 4 and 5 o'clock in the afternoon, too late for the morning papers and too early for the evening ones, there is not a general explosion heard up and down the street, scattering a legion of antiquated and house-bred notions and whims to the four winds for an airing, and so the evil cure itself. How womankind, who are confined to the house still more than men, stand it, I do not know, but I have ground to suspect that most of them do not stand it at all. When early in a summer afternoon we've been shaking the dust of the village from the skirts of our garments, making haste past those houses with purely Doric or Gothic fronts, which have such an air of repose about them, my companion whispers that probably about these times their occupants are all gone to bed. Then it is that I appreciate the beauty and the glory of architecture, which itself never turns in, but forever stands out and erect, keeping watch over the slumberers. No doubt temperament, and above all age, have a good deal to do with it. As a man grows older, his ability to sit still and follow indoor occupations increases. He grows vespertinal in his habits as the evening of life approaches, till at last he comes forth only just before sundown and gets all the walk that he requires in half an hour. But the walking of which I speak has nothing in it akin to taking exercise, as it is called, as the sick take medicine at stated hours, as the swinging of dumbbells or chairs, but is itself the enterprise and adventure of the day. If you would get exercise, go in search of the springs of life. Think of man's swinging dumbbells for his health when those springs are bubbling up in far-off pastures unsought by him. Moreover, you must walk like a camel, which is said to be the only beast which ruminates when walking. When a traveler asked Wordsworth's servant to show him her master's study, she answered, "Here is his library, but his study is out of doors." When we walk, we naturally go to the fields and woods. what would become of us if we walked only in a garden or a mall? Even some sects of philosophers have felt the necessity of importing the woods to themselves since they didn't go to the woods. They planted groves and walks where they took subdialis ambulations in porticos open to the air. Of course, it is of no use to direct our steps in the woods if they do not carry us thither. I am alarmed when it happens that I've walked a mile into the woods bodily without getting there in spirit. In my afternoon walk, I would fain forget all my morning occupations and my obligations to society, but it sometimes happens that I can't easily shake off the village. The thought of some work will run in my head, and I am not where my body is. I am out of my senses. In my walks, I would fain return to my senses. What business have I in the woods if I am thinking of something out of the woods? I suspect myself and cannot help a shudder when I find myself so implicated even in what are called good works, for this may sometimes happen. My vicinity offers many good walks, and though for so many years I've walked almost every day and sometimes for several days together, I've not yet exhausted them. An absolutely new prospect is a great happiness, and I can still get this any afternoon. 2 or 3 hours walking will carry me to as strange a country as I expect ever to see. A single farmhouse which I had not seen before is sometimes as good as the dominions of the King of Dahomey. There is, in fact, a sort of harmony discoverable between the capabilities of the landscape within a circle of 10 miles radius, or the limits of an afternoon walk, and the 80 years and 10 of human life. It will never become quite familiar to you. Nowadays, almost all of man's improvements, so-called, as the building of houses and the cutting down of the forest and all large trees, simply deform the landscape and make it more and more tame and cheap. A people who would begin by burning the fences and let the forest stand. I saw the fences half consumed, their ends lost in the middle of the prairie, and some worldly miser with a surveyor looking after his bounds while heaven had taken place around him, and he did not see the angels going to and fro, but he was looking for an old post hole in the middle of paradise. I looked again and saw him standing in the middle of a boggy Stygian fen, surrounded by devils, and he had found his bounds without a doubt. 3 little stones where a stake had been driven, and looking nearer, I saw that the Prince of Darkness was his surveyor. I can easily walk 10, 15, 20, any number of miles, commencing at my own door without going by any house, without crossing a road except where the fox and the mink do, first along by the river, and then the brook, and then the meadow and the woodside. There are square miles in my vicinity which have no inhabitant. From many a hill I can see civilization and the abodes of man afar. The farmers and their works are scarcely more obvious than woodchucks in their burrows. Man and his affairs, church and state and school, trade and commerce, and manufactures and agricultures, even politics, the most alarming of them all, I am pleased to see how little space they occupy in the landscape. Politics is but a narrow field, and that still narrower highway yonder leads to it. I sometimes direct the traveler thither. If you would go to the political world, follow that great road. Follow that market man. Keep his dust in your eyes, and it will lead you straight to it. For it, too, has its place merely and does not occupy all space. I pass from it as from a bean field into the forest, and it is forgotten. In 1/2 hour I can walk off to some portion of the earth's surface where a man does not stand from 1 year's end to another, and there, consequently, politics are not, for they are but as the cigar smoke of a man. And that's the end of that little excerpt from Henry David Thoreau's essay called Walking. Hope you enjoyed it. I just love it. I will see you next time. This is Nancy Williams for Petals and Prose.
This is KUSR HD1 89.5 Logan, KUSK HD1 88.5 Vernal, KUSL HD1 89.3 Richfield, KUST HD1 88.7 Moab, KCEU 89.7 Price, and KUSU FM HD1 91.5 Logan.